not to sleepy, didn't eat too much, just right. It's hard when there's so much good food, it's hard to kind of find the right balance, yeah? You have to really restrain. And this is the next topic, is about restraint. So this is good timing. So we have been looking at the Noble Eightfold Path, and we have seen kind of how the foundation of the whole path is the idea of right view coming from the Buddha. And then once you have the right view, then you get the right aim, the right purpose in life. And that once you have the right purpose, you start living a moral life. So you have right action, you have right speech, and you also have right livelihood. Right livelihood is also part of that. I'm not going to talk about it anymore, but right livelihood is essentially about living so it is in accordance with right action. Yeah, you don't oppress other beings through your livelihood, and that is really what it is about. There are lots of work in this world that is really wonderful. Someone told me that she had two daughters who were both doctors. I thought, wow, that's really nice kind of livelihood. Yeah, both doctors, or any kind of job like that, teachers and nurses and people who support others. Yeah, these are all really wonderful livelihoods. But one of the things to remember about whatever job it is you do, even if, you know, whatever it is, usually it has an aspect to it whereby you are helping other people. Even if you seemingly don't have a job, seem kind of ordinary, maybe you're working in the bank or something like that, there's always customers, there's always co-workers. So if you have the right attitude to whatever job you have, attitude of, you know, helping your customers, helping your co-workers or whatever, all of those you can kind of enhance your spiritual path just by thinking about your work in the right way. So it's all in the intention. What do we intend? And you can make almost anything into something positive as long as you think about it in the right way. That's kind of the critical issue usually. So once you have all the moral factors into place, the kind of external morality, then the next thing is to purify your mind. Yeah. So we do one coarse purification, then the more refined purification, and this is what happens with right effort. So now we're going to look at the idea of right effort. So I'd like to go to page 85 in the little booklet. 85. And the sutta is called Sloping East, is the sutta. This is the standard explanation of right effort in the suttas, and we have seen it already, but I'll just explain it in a little bit more detail perhaps so you get some idea what is meant by this. This is from the Padana Sanghita, is that what it's called? This sutta goes as follows. This is the first sutta in the, I think it's called the Padana Sanghita, something like that. Is that right? Or something like that? Samapadana Sutta. Okay, thank you. So, at Savati, there the Buddha said, mendicants, there are these four right efforts. What for? It's when a mendicant generates enthusiasm, tries, makes an effort, exerts the mind, and strives so that bad and wholesome qualities don't arise. Yeah, so this is the first one, and here again you have this idea, this word enthusiasm that we came across before, which is chanda in Pali, I think enthusiasm is a nice word because it doesn't have the sense of desire related to it, even though the word chanda in Pali can be called desire, it's a wholesome kind of desire, so similar in many ways to enthusiasm. And then you have all these other words here, which all have to do that you put in an effort to avoid the unwholesome qualities. So this is all about, you're kind of wandering around in your daily life or even in your meditation practice. And if you're not careful, the unwholesome qualities can arise in the mind. So you have to have some kind of awareness. And then you kind of generate, you ensure that that awareness is in place. And then when you see that unwholesome qualities are about to arise, then you take another route and you find a way of avoiding those unwholesome qualities. And this is what this is about. So it's about stopping bad things from happening. Yeah? And this obviously is very advantageous. If you can stop it before it's happening, it means that you can maintain a fairly pure mind. So this is called the right effort of restraint, usually, because you stop things, bad things, from arising here. So this is the first one. All of these four kind of work together. The second one is they generate enthusiasm, try, make an effort, exert the mind, and strive so that bad, unwholesome qualities that have already arisen are given up. So sometimes your restraint does not work. So then you have to make an effort to overcome those bad qualities that arise. One of the things to be aware of here, it uses all this language that seems to require a lot of effort, exert the mind. But remember when we looked at this other sutta, the Dvaita Vitakka Sutta, etc., it actually says there that the effort, when you're making an effort, doesn't necessarily mean a lot of willpower. Often it just means turning the mind in the right direction, using your wisdom, and then allowing the wisdom to overcome those unwholesome qualities. So often wisdom power is what it is about, rather than willpower. And it is far more effective, and I might talk about this in a second again, why it is more effective. So this is how you overcome the arisen unwholesome qualities. You generate enthusiasm, try, make an effort, exert the mind, and strive so that the good qualities, skillful qualities, arise. So this is like when you are, you know, trying to, in your meditation, you gently nudge the mind a little bit to give rise to some positive feelings, or you kind of look at your fellows in the spiritual life, and you look at them with a kind of kindly eye, and you remember their good qualities, and you remember the generosity among you, and all of these things. You give rise to these things, and then you can feel the good qualities inside of you arise as a consequence. I'm sure very often you see this happening. And then the last one is that once these wholesome qualities do arise, then you have to strive to maintain them so they don't get lost. So you generate enthusiasm, try, make an effort, exert the mind, and strive so that the skillful qualities that have arisen remain, are not lost, but increase and mature and are completed by development. These are the four right efforts. So you, in the last one, it's a bit like, you know, when you learn how to give rise to good qualities, you keep on doing it, and then you keep on doing it, and gradually these things become more and more powerful. This can be within your meditation practice, that you focus on an object, and then it kind of keeps on increasing the good qualities, or it can be more generally, the general qualities in daily life, whereby you become more generous, or more mindful, and more kind-hearted in daily life activities. So this is kind of throughout your practice, whatever it is that you're doing, these things are to be used. So you can see there that it is all about reducing and removing unwholesome qualities of mind and giving rise to and improving the wholesome qualities of mind. This is what the whole path is about. This is what Buddhism is about. Because as long as you do that, it means that you're heading in the direction of something very positive. You're moving in the right direction. You don't even have to worry about whether you're going to get jhanas or stream entry. Many people tell me that, I'm aiming for stream entry this life. I think, okay, good, but don't think too much about that. Leave that at the back of your mind and focus more on the practical, simple little things in daily life. How can I live? And then you judge your progress simply by whether you are slowly growing in good qualities and declining in bad ones. If you are, you're on the right track. Eventually, you will have no choice but to become a stream enter. Even if you don't want to become one, you will become one. So, there's no turning back anymore. So this is the good thing. And it's... So that is how it works. So now I would like to have a look at a little bit more of a concrete example. And this is a sutta from the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourse. It's the next one on page 86. It's called Restraint. And this is one of the suttas that give a very a fairly detailed explanation of these four right efforts. Yeah, and every time you get a detailed explanation of what things are, of course you are missing, some things are missing out, because a detailed explanation by nature has to focus on certain areas. So this may not be a complete explanation of what this is about, but at least it gives you an idea of how these things can be put into practice in daily life. So the first one is the first of the four right efforts, yeah? The effort to restrain. So there are four altogether, and this is the effort to restrain, the effort to give up, the effort to develop, and the effort to preserve. These are exactly the four that we had a look at just a minute ago. And so then, what, mendicants, is the effort to restrain? So this is how restraint happens. And what we are coming to now is the standard formula for sense restraint in the suttas. And this is quite an important formula in the suttas, because whenever you see the gradual training, the training that takes you all the way from the beginning all the way to awakening, this is always part of that. This is one of the core ideas in the Buddhist practice, this idea of sense restraint. And it's important to get this right, because as I mentioned the other day, the word restraint has a very much a feeling of force to it. But really, when it comes to this passage here, it actually doesn't mean that, or it doesn't always mean that. It may mean that perhaps occasionally, but very often it actually means something else. So let's have a look at this. When a mendicant sees a sight with the eyes, they don't get caught up in the features and details. If the faculty of sight were left unrestrained, bad, unwholesome qualities of desire and aversion would become overwhelming. For this reason, they practice restraint, protecting the faculty of sight and achieving its restraint. So this is so here. You see things, yeah. We can't avoid seeing things. You see things all the time. There's not a solution to go with your eyes closed all the time. That doesn't really work. We have to see things. So you see stuff. Stuff comes into your head through your eyes, and then there is different ways of reacting to the things that we see. And very often we can react with either we like something or we dislike it, or a lot of the time we're kind of neutral, we don't really care, it's kind of not one or the other. So what it says here is that when you see something with the eye, you don't get caught up in its features and details. And caught up here, the Pali word is gahi, and gahi means that you nimitagahi anubyanjanagahi. Gahi is like to grasp or to take hold of, yeah? He translates it here as don't get caught up in it. So you don't grasp these features or details of what you are seeing. Yeah? And what does that mean, to grasp? And what it means is like your mind sticks to them, the mind doesn't let go. So after you have seen something, yeah, this is about seeing specifically, it's like your mind lingers on that thing. It doesn't just carry on and be mindful of what the next thing is, but it lingers on that thing. And the lingering happens because of two reasons. Either because you like what you're seeing, in which case desire arises, yeah, so you kind of stay with that, or because you have aversion, because you have negativity towards it. And because you have negativity towards it, then also you linger. Okay, it's very, very good. Yeah. Thank you, Jerry. Jerry is kind of the upatak. He runs around serving us drinks and coffees and everything. That's very, very nice. So you have all of these. So this is how you. This is what is meant by grasping here, yeah, or by getting caught up in it, is the sense that you either desire it or you have aversion towards it. And because of that, your mind doesn't let go. It doesn't move on to the next one. And you would perhaps notice this in your meditation. Yeah, it's nice and peaceful, and suddenly some noise appears. And then sometimes you may not like that noise. Yeah, and you think, oh, that noise, yeah. And then your mind is kind of stuck. You have grasped onto that noise. And then, because you have grasped onto it, the mind kind of gets stuck there. And you can't let go and just go back to the silence again. And you kind of think about it or something like that. Yeah, so the idea is when you meditate, and this is the kind of the point here, is to get that distance between yourself and what is happening around you. So when the noise comes, you don't have any aversion to it regardless of what happens, nor do you desire it if it is very desirable or beautiful. You stand back and you allow it just to come. And because there is no reaction, as soon as the noise disappears, you are back again with the breath. You may be even with the breath when the noise is there. It doesn't really disturb the mind at all because you're just standing back watching things in the world. And to be able to do that has to do with right outlook. You have to look at the world in the right way. You have to know that noises are inevitable. You have to know that people sometimes are a little bit noisier. Yeah, the people around you, sometimes they do things. And this is just the nature of people. And then you don't allow yourself to become upset. Last one we had a baby, yeah, crying and making noises throughout the whole, most of the meditation, which was kind of nice, kind of sweet, but a little bit disturbing, but nothing too much. You just let it be. Okay, the baby kind of does a little gurgling or whatever it is that it does, and then you allow that to be, and it's, you don't, there is no issue there. Or even if some hoons do some kind of, they rev up the cars a little bit in the street or whatever, it doesn't actually bother you that much. You allow, you know, this is the nature of people, especially young people, they got to drive the cars in kind of noisy ways, because that's what young people like to do. And so, okay, fine. And you kind of carry on like that. But you can see it very easily in your meditation practice, how you get caught up in things, because there you already have a degree of peace. You can see how this works. But of course, in daily life, it is also happening. Yeah, all the time it's happening. But you can learn about the process in your meditation practice. So this is what we want to avoid. We want to have that flow where the mind just flows through things, because that is how you can maintain mindfulness, and then you can just be aware, and that is how you stop the greed, the ill will, and then it becomes more and more peaceful because of that. As soon as you get caught up, you lose your peace, and that then the meditation kind of halts. But if you're able to stand back, things tend to become more and more peaceful. Your breath becomes more refined, and then you are on the way to this beautiful Anapanasati Sutta with all the 16 steps. And you kind of, woof, off you go on the 16 steps. So you avoid the grasping, getting caught up in the features and details. These are just maybe the whole sight that you see, or details of it, yeah, whatever it is. That's really all that means. And because if you do leave it unrestrained, if you allow the world to pull your faculties in, then the qualities arise in your mind. You either desire it or you have aversion to that object. You either like it or you dislike it. This is what it means. And then once you are caught up in that, then your mind is far from stillness. It's restless. You lose the ability to just be mindful and be aware. And this is the problem that happens at that particular point. These unwholesome qualities arise, and you lose your happiness as well. Yeah, this is really what, of course, why this is a problematic. So for this reason, you practice restraint of the faculty of sight. You achieve restraint over it. So there's two things that you have to do here. First of all, you have to have the awareness. You have to know what is going on. And very often you can see that something is happening which may be about to give you a little bit of desire or aversion. Yeah, you don't really want this, or you want it a little bit too much or whatever. You can see that happening. So this is like the guarding. Yeah, it is the mindfulness faculty which is aware of what is going on. So you guard, you see what is happening. And this is kind of the initial thing that is required. You can only have sense restraint if you have a certain degree of mindfulness. So you have the mindfulness, and then because you have the mindfulness and these things are happening, then when the desire and aversion arises, you have to know what to do. Yeah. Otherwise, if you don't know what to do, then it's not enough to have mindfulness. You have to have the instructions for what to do at this particular point. So what do we do when aversion arises? What is the right thing to do? And it depends on the situation, it depends on the degree of aversion and desire. Sometimes we can just remain mindful if it is a weak thing and just allow it to pass, and it's not a problem. If it's only very small aversion or desire, it's not an issue. You stand back, you allow it to come and go, and then it's gone. But sometimes it can be more strong, and it can really carry us away, and we can kind of get caught in a stream of thought about all kinds of stuff. So sometimes you need something more than just observing it as it happens. And this is where those ideas or those things that other sutta we had a look at, the overcoming of resentment sutta, comes in. Resentment is often the most difficult thing in these things. So then you kind of bring those things into the picture. Yeah, you remind yourself of actually all of these things that you're getting caught up in. They are so unsatisfactory and uninteresting anyway. Now I'm doing what really matters. I'm doing my meditation. If it is people that you are feeling resentful towards, or maybe get some anger or ill will for, then you use the Agata Pativinaya Sutta, the overcoming of resentment, reminding yourself of the good qualities of that person, reminding yourself of the, being compassionate towards them. You have to do it quite quickly, because once it gets really strong in your mind, it can be too late. So you use that to overcome. So you have those tools ready, at the back of your mind. So when these things happen, you know how to apply them. But a lot of the time, all you have to do is just stand back and allow things to be here. And then the flow is there, and then there is not so much of a problem. So you need two things. You need the mindfulness, and you need the tools to be able to deal with problems when they arise. And this is true in meditation, but it's also true outside of meditation in daily life. Both of those situations, you can use these things. So wisdom power is the trick here. It says restraint. You restrain the eye faculty, but you try to use wisdom to overcome any ill will or negativity that arises. Okay. So that is restraint. Yeah, this is the very important part, again, of the gradual training. So you don't allow desire and aversion to overwhelm you, because you have the right outlook, the right way of looking at the things of the world. So you enable yourself to kind of avoid these things. And this is how you restrain the eye faculty, you protect the eye faculty. And then it's exactly the same with all the other senses. Yeah, the sound, you hear a sound, you smell an odor with the nose, you taste a flavor with the tongue, you feel a touch with the body, or you even know something with the mind. Yeah, the mind is also included here. So again, you don't allow yourself to get caught up. You have some fantasy or something, and you see something nice in your mind, and then exactly the same principle. You don't allow yourself to be caught up. You are aware of what's happening in your mind. And this, of course, is the most difficult thing, because the mind is very fast and things kind of flash before you. Before you know it, you are kind of heading down the wrong track. But even there, if you have enough mindfulness, you will be able to see when you're moving in an undesirable direction. And then you do exactly the same thing again, and then you avoid being caught up in these things. And it is not so hard to do. It is hard to do if you're going to do it all the time with every kind of thought, but it's not so hard to do with the most coarse kind of ill will and negativity, especially. This is something everyone can do, because we tend to be aware when these things are arising. And as long as you invest a little bit of effort into building up these tools, seeing the good side in other people, having compassion for others and all of these things, you will be able to use this when ill will or aversion arises in your mind. Quickly use it, and bang, it is gone. And this is a very interesting and very powerful way of dealing with defilements, far more powerful than restraint coming from willpower, because wisdom power actually overcomes the defilement completely. We'll have more of a look at this when we come to the next one of these ones here. So that is the restraint. This is to avoid bad unwholesome qualities arising. But what if they arise anyway? Restraint isn't going to be 100% successful if we can make it, a little bit successful, that's good already. If you can make it 10%, great. And then if you can increase the percentage over time, even better. But there's sometimes Mara is going to get the better of you. Huh? Yeah, and when Mara gains access, bang, suddenly you know that you have been caught up with these desires and aversions. And then, you have to deal with that. And this is the next one. Huh? And this is the one which is called the right effort to give up. And what mendicance is the effort to give up? It is when a mendicant does not tolerate sensual, malicious, or cruel, or maybe ruthless thoughts that arise. But you give those thoughts up, get rid of it, eliminate it, and obliterate it. They don't tolerate any bad, unwholesome qualities that have arisen there. But give them up, get rid of them, eliminate them, and obliterate them. This is called the effort to give up. Now, again, like I mentioned to you before, when we had a look at the Dvaita Vitakka Sutta during the previous part of the retreat, again, these words that I used here are very similar to the words used in the Dvaita Vitakka Sutta. The idea, the words of eliminating and obliterating and giving up and all of this. So it might give you the impression that here, again, you have to use a lot of willpower. But as we saw in the Dvaita Vitakka Sutta, the way to deal with these unwholesome thoughts is actually not through willpower. The whole sutta is about how to use wisdom to overcome these things. Yeah, you remember the Buddha says that when these things arise, then you remember that this is going to be for my own suffering. Yeah, affliction is a word used there. It will be for my own affliction, for the affliction of others, and for the suffering of both. And when you, just by remembering that, you actually let go of these things. So you have to really understand this in a deep way, in such a deep way that as soon as you kind of touch, as soon as you know it's there, oh, you don't want to go there because you know it's painful. That same similarly as the hot piece of coal that you pick up by accident. Ah, don't need to think for letting it go because you know it's going to be suffering, so let it go straight away. And this is exactly the same thing with these kind of things. You know the danger. You know it leads away from nibbana, as it says there. It leads to the cessation of panya, of wisdom. And it also has the agata. It leads to difficulties. So this is all you have to do. Yeah, understanding the problem of these things. And as you understand that, using that wisdom, you let it go. And again, you have the same similes as I just mentioned a second ago about the how to deal with difficult people. That's also kind of wisdom, remembering their good qualities, having compassion for them. And again, you give up the anger and ill will in these ways. The reason why this is very useful is that if we try to restrain things through willpower, again, when you use willpower, you're kind of holding things down, trying to suppress them, hold them in place. And very often, if you use that willpower, two things happen. You only have so much willpower, and after a while you can feel really tired, and when you feel tired, you know, everything just comes back again, because you can't sustain it any longer. And if you just hold it down, it tends to come back with a vengeance later on. But if you use wisdom power, if you see the problem with these things, you actually eliminate them in a much deeper sense. Because you know there's no point in holding on to what is suffering, because you know that. You actually let go properly. You don't just suppress, you don't just restrain, you don't hold it down with willpower, you actually let it go completely. So wisdom power has lots of benefits. It's a more profound sense of letting go. It doesn't deplete your energy so much because you don't have to kind of use willpower. The downside is that you need to reflect a little bit to be able to build up that wisdom to enable you to use it when the time comes. And then it is obliterated. It is gone, the problem. So there you are. That is overcoming of the unwholesome qualities. Make sense? Yeah? Okay, good. I'm glad it makes sense, because that's what I'm sort of trying to, hoping it will make sense. But if you don't understand, please ask. So that is the two things about overcoming the unwholesome, stopping it from arising, and also once it has arisen, how to deal with it. And now we come to the other side of the coin, and that is how to develop the good qualities of the mind. Yeah? And this obviously is just as important. And here the Buddha says, and what mendicants is the effort to develop? It is when a mendicant develops the awakening factor of mindfulness, the awakening factor of investigation of principles, the awakening factor of energy, the awakening factor of joy or rapture, the awakening factor of tranquility, the awakening factor of samadhi, the awakening factor of equanimity, or evenness of mind perhaps, which rely on seclusion, fading away and cessation, and ripen as letting go. This is called the effort to develop. So here we are suddenly dealing with the awakening factors. And this is the very end of the path. This is all about mindfulness and how that goes to samadhi. And this is what I mentioned before. I mentioned idea that the effort is actually very broad in Buddhism. And sometimes it also overlaps with the other factors. And here we see how it overlaps with sammasati and sammasamadhi. And in one way, sammasati, sammasamadhi, and sammavayama, right effort, it's almost as if the three often go together like this, like a group of phenomena, group of factors that kind of work together in this way here. So we use right effort to guide us in the right way to develop the samadhi and the sati. And this is what we're seeing here. So when you are developing basically your meditation practice, this is what this is saying. You're sitting down watching the breath, and when you are watching the breath in the right way, so it gives rise to these things, then you are doing the effort to develop. Yeah, that is what is happening. That's really all you have to do. So it's a very simple kind of effort. So remember that, again, it said in the previous sutta, we just saw it said that you use enthusiasm, you try, you make an effort, you exert your mind, and you strive. But sometimes all you have to do is really sit back and watch the breath. Yeah, very simple. Don't really do very much. Do as little as possible and allow the whole thing to develop. And then you are doing all of those things, putting forth the effort. So it's important to understand the idea of effort is very varied here. Sometimes the right effort is just to stand back and watch and to be aware and not do very much at all. A great variety of efforts depending on exactly what it is that you are doing here. So that is the effort to develop. I think that's enough on that one. I'll just go to the last one. And what mendicants is the effort to preserve? It's when a mendicant preserves a meditation subject or object. That's a fine foundation for samadhi. The perception of a skeleton, a worm-infested corpse, a livid corpse, a split open corpse, or a bloated corpse. This is called the effort to preserve. These are the four efforts. So if you want to get some samadhi, this is what you have to do. Yeah, you have to get the corpse out and start observing the corpse. But the corpse contemplation is actually a contemplation of imagination. You don't actually have to see any corpse, you just have to kind of bring it up in your mind, and that's really good enough actually. So that means that you don't have the smell at least, because you just have it in your mind. That's kind of helpful. So here the idea of preservation is just that you are having some success in your meditation, yeah, and the meditation is going well, and because it is going well, you preserve that, you keep on going until eventually you reach immersion. So very similar to the previous one, except that here it is a little bit more preserving. You don't actually develop so much, whereas the previous one you develop. The two are very closely related to each other. It's very hard to kind of to distinguish too much between them. It's a little bit strange that the skeleton and the corpse is used as the examples of a meditation subject, because I think this is the only place in the suttas, apart from the Satipatthana Sutta, where this is found. There you are. There are many ways of developing the immersion, the samadhi, the breath would perhaps have been a more natural one, because the breath is used everywhere for this. So you could substitute with the breath, you can put that in there if you like. So any one of these subjects that lead to samadhi is really what is meant here. So that is the four right efforts. Yeah, it encompasses pretty much everything. And this is a little bit limited because it kind of ties it down to specific things. But really, any time you develop a good quality and you reduce the bad quality, you are practicing the four right efforts. So it's a very broad and very large part of what meditation is about and the Buddhist path is about. So then as you do this, as you purify your mind through the four right efforts, you reduce your ill will, and perhaps you even reduce your desire for worldly things a little bit, because you realize the limitations of the worldly things. As you do that, there comes a point when your mind is quite mindful. Yeah, especially when you go on the meditation retreat, you feel your mind is quite stable. It isn't being pulled around by aversion and desire so much anymore. And at that point, you come to Sammasati, the seventh factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. There are still some defilements in the mind, but they're quite subtle at this point. Yeah, you have taken away the coarse defilements that pull you around, and you're fairly present in the present moment, and the mind is fairly stable with Sammasati. That is the right time to move on to the seventh factor of the Noble Eightfold Path and start the Satipatthana practice. It's important to get this sequence roughly right, because again, if you don't get it right, then you'll be doing one thing when you should be doing something else. You try to watch the breath. Well, actually, what you really should do is overcome some of those defilements first of all, because they're going to stop you. Or you start watching the breath and you're not even keeping the five precepts yet, and that kind of stuff. So get these things in the right order, otherwise it will not work properly. So now, what I will do now is to have a look at some of the suttas that have to do with Sammasati. This is going to be a few of them from the Satipatthana Sanghutta, and also a short extract from the Digha Nikaya 16, which shows you kind of the purpose of Satipatthana and meditation practice. Let us start off with this short extract from the Digha Nikaya 16, the Maha Parinibbana Sutta, that gives a context for all of this. So this is the four applications of mindfulness. Four applications of mindfulness. Okay, that's probably my writing. It must be mine, because that's not what Ajahn Sujata calls it. Okay, so you don't know who has written these things. You just get the book and you have no idea who it comes from. So some of it is from Ajahn Sujata, a little bit is from me. Occasionally I made a mistake and put I.B. Horner's translation in there. So you get a bit of a mishmash, which is kind of makes it interesting for you. So you can have a kind of a game later on guessing who translated this particular sutta. Okay, so Digha Nikaya 16, a short little extract. And this is as the Buddha is coming very close to the end of his life. He has almost died during the rains retreat in Vesali, and he has had deliberately to keep his life going so that he didn't pass away at that particular time. This is this point, and this is what he's saying to Venerable Ananda. He's telling that I'm advanced in years and have reached the final stage of life. I'm currently 80 years old. Yeah, I've reached the final stage of life. There's nothing there about I could live on for an eon, as you can see. Just as a decrepit cart keeps going by relying on straps, in the same way, the realized one's body keeps going by relying on straps, or so you'd think. In other words, just as if it is relying on straps. Yeah, it's kind of falling apart a little bit. Sometimes the realized one, not focusing on any signs, and with the cessation of certain feelings, enters and remains in the signless samadhi, Cheto Samadhi, Samadhi of the heart. This is a special kind of samadhi that you can enter. This is the Animitta Samadhi, is called in Pali. Only then does the realized one's body become more comfortable. You have to enter a samadhi state to be comfortable. So he's obviously getting old and worn out. So, Ananda, be your own island, your own refuge, with no other refuge. Let the teaching be your island and your refuge, with no other refuge. Yeah, so this is this famous saying of the Buddha that he says, don't have any other refuge in the world except yourself and the teachings of the Buddha. Yeah, all other things. Ananda has just complained, oh, you know, I was really scared and worried when these things happened. And the Buddha says, well, what do you expect? All things that are dear and agreeable to you, it's not exactly here, but it's somewhere else in the same sutta. All things that are dear and agreeable to you will become otherwise. You know, don't hold on, don't attach to things that are going to become otherwise. And this is why he's now saying, be an island unto yourself. Have the Dhamma as your island. Why? Because all these external things in the world are inherently unreliable, uncontrollable. They're going to change. There's only one way of having a sense of refuge. You have to find it within yourself. You have to be your own refuge. Use the Dhamma as the refuge. Then there is a sense of finding a solution to the problems of life and the problems of the world. So it's a very nice message, and it makes so much sense when you think about it. It's so easy to understand. Everything in the sensory world is inherently unreliable. It's going to let you down. It's going to be problematic. You have to find the refuge within. It's the only place where you have some degree of control, if you like. You can do something with your own inner life by developing it in the right way, but the external world is completely out of control. It is problematic. Yeah. So how do we do that? How do we be a refuge unto ourselves? And this is the next thing the Buddha talks about. This is why I brought this up at this point. How does a mendicant do this? It's when a mendicant meditates by observing an aspect of the body. Keen, aware, mindful, rid of desire and aversion for the world. The four satipatthanas. Yeah, this is the standard description of the four satipatthanas. They meditate observing an aspect of feeling, of mind, of principles. Keen, aware, and mindful, rid of desire and aversion for the world. That's how a mendicant is their own island, their own refuge, with no other refuge. Why is that? Because here you go within. You go to the breath, you look within yourself, instead of actually being interested in worldly phenomena. You actually let the world go, and you go to your inner home inside. And one of those beautiful little sayings by Ajahn Chah that I also mentioned before, the real home is within you, because that is where you find precisely a refuge from these incredibly unsatisfactory external phenomena. And you can imagine when you are able to let go of the world, and you know this to some extent already, when you have a little bit of peace in your meditation, you feel like you're within yourself. It feels kind of safe. And not only does it feel safe, it actually feels also very joyous and happy when you get it right. It feels really, it's a very positive feeling to be within yourself in this way. You're watching the breath, all you have in the world is the you and the breath together. And actually, it is one of the best things that can happen to you. Who would have thought that just hanging out with the breath was going to be so nice? Who needs that BMW or whatever it is? No need for those things, yeah? Breath is much better than the BMW. Yeah, that's a nice comparison. Yeah, comparing the breath to a BMW. Nobody has done that before. So, the breath is better than kind of these fancy cars. Chuck those fancy cars out. Get the breath in instead. This is what the Buddha is saying here. It is pretty much what he's saying. Yeah, except that, yes, all of those external things. So you find that refuge within. So peaceful, so beautiful, so happy, so contented, so delighted with just staying within. Yeah, and what an amazing thing that is. It is so simple. The simplest things in the universe are far more attractive than all these complications outside. And suddenly you know that you have found your true refuge. And this is why the Buddha is advising us to do this. Precisely because this is far more sustainable. And of course that development of the mind that you are doing in this way is also what you then take with you as you pass on into the future. Whereas that BMW, it goes to your children, yeah? That you can't take that with you. That is kind of left behind, and that is the problem. I say BMW all the time because I was driven with this in Perth. We have one of the supporters was driving me home, and this fellow had this incredibly fancy BMW. So he whacked me in, and I just looked around. I thought, wow. So that's why I kind of say BMW, but it could be any fancy thing that we own, yeah, in the world there. But so that is where we find our refuge. And it's such a... the more you think about it, it's actually very obvious. It's just that the problem of creating the refuge within, it takes commitment and it takes perseverance. But as you do, you actually gradually, you do create that refuge within. Every time you do an act of kindness, every time you do an act of morality, every time you do something positive in this world, you are actually building up that inner refuge. And you are creating the cause and conditions eventually to be able to go into much deeper meditation as well. All of these things come together. So this is kind of the right view coming together with the Samadhi, coming together with the Satipatthanas, everything kind of falling into place. That's how the teaching is the island, and the island, the refuge. We know of the refuge. You're using the teaching of Satipatthana to guide you as you do this. Whether now or after I have passed away, any who shall live as their own island, as their own refuge, with no other refuge, but the teaching as their island, and as their refuge, with no other refuge, those mendicants of mine who want to train shall be among the best of the best. Sounds good, doesn't it? The best of the best. No more messing around, really, just getting in there. So this is one of these really nice little teachings that show you one of the great purposes of Satipatthana, first of all, just to find refuge from a world that is inherently unreliable. And of course, eventually it goes well beyond that. It goes beyond to the ending and cessation of everything. But that is kind of the starting point. And that's pretty good already, isn't it? It's already a really nice place to begin. So, having looked at that sutta, I'm going to move on to the next one. This sutta is called A Monk, and it goes as follows. I'm not even sure why I have picked some of these suttas. I can't remember anymore, so it will be exciting for me to read this one and see what happens when we have a look at this. So, at one time, the Buddha was staying near Savatthi in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. Then a mendicant went up to the Buddha, bowed, sat down to one side, and said to him, "Sir, may the Buddha please teach me the Dhamma in brief. When I've heard it, I will live alone, withdrawn, diligent, keen, and resolute." So this is how monks and nuns would sometimes go to the Buddha and say, "Please give me teaching so I can kind of become an arahant." That's kind of the idea. This is kind of the purpose of this. And then the Buddha replies, "This is exactly how some foolish people ask me for something. But when the teaching has been explained, they think only of following me around." It's kind of interesting. Following the Buddha around is the wrong way. You're supposed to live in seclusion, live by yourself. Yeah, not supposed to have these large gatherings. You're supposed to be staying in seclusion as much as possible. So this monk says, or maybe nun, "Sir, may the Buddha teach me the Dhamma in brief. Please, please teach me." That's what he's saying here. Yeah, may the Holy One teach me the Dhamma in brief. Hopefully, I can understand the meaning of what the Buddha says. Hopefully, I can become an heir of the Buddha's teaching. So maybe the Buddha says this to kind of stir up a little bit of urgency in this monk. Maybe he has been a bit too slack. So the Buddha said, "Okay, don't be careful." And then this monk is starting to get a bit worried. So then he listens more carefully. And of course, this is one of those things, is to get people to listen can often be the hardest part. And so the Buddha uses some skillful means. And then he says, "Well then, mendicant, you should purify the starting point in wholesome or skillful qualities." What is the starting point of skillful qualities? Well-purified ethics and correct view. When your ethics are well-purified and your view is correct, then you should develop the four kinds of mindfulness meditation. So, And now I know why I picked the sutta. The reason I picked it was simply just to point out again the importance. The mindfulness meditation, Satipatthana, is always said in the suttas to be based on two things. On morality, sila, yeah, on the one hand, and on the other hand, on right view. And this is why he says here, what does he say again? Correct view. This is the ujjukaditti, straight view, yeah, is the Pali word for this. So these two things are required for you to be able to practice the Satipatthana well. Yeah, sila is required because you want to feel good about yourself. You want to go into the meditation not be too concerned about ill will and desires dragging you this way and that way. So this is obviously very important, and I've already looked at this in quite a bit. So sila is required. The better your sila, the better your meditation is going. And ujjukaditti, the reason why straight view is important, of course, is that you prioritize the meditation over other things. You understand that all these other things are actually not really all that meaningful in the long run. Yeah, they don't really give you that satisfaction, the contentment that is important in life, whereas meditation and a spiritual path does. So you're not really interested in those things. One of the biggest hindrances in meditation practice is that we are actually interested in all this other stuff. That is why the mind goes out to these things. Why do we think about, you know, all the things in our life? Because they are important to us. And of course, to some extent, they are going to be important to you, but you want to lessen their importance a little bit, get things in the right order, get the spiritual life on top, and then these other things don't no longer distract you so much in your meditation practice. So this is right view, remembering what matters. And this is, again, why the Buddha says all of these things like, all that is dear and pleasing to you must become otherwise. Okay, if that's true, maybe I should focus more on other things instead and get the priorities in the right order. And just again, to make it absolutely clear, this does not mean that one neglects one worldly things, one doesn't neglect one's family or anything like that. It rather, one just remembers that what should be prioritized. And usually when you prioritize your spiritual life, the rest of your life also actually turns out to be better, because you become a more kind, more caring, more compassionate, more understanding person. You have more time for the people around you. And because of all of that, it actually, everything gets better. Yeah, everything is improved as a consequence. It's a bit like, you know, sometimes my parents say to me, oh, I would want to see you more often. But I tell them, actually, quality much more important than quantity. Yeah, so you may not see me so often, but actually you get more quality out of me. I've actually got something useful to say now. Didn't have anything useful to say before, but now I've got something useful to say. Yeah? And they say, maybe you have a point. Okay, so then it's okay. Yeah? So this is kind of how things work out. That is that little sutta on the foundations of the Satipatthana practice. Let's have a quick look at the next sutta as well. This next sutta is also quite nice. This is the Cook's Sutta. Sutta Sutta, exactly, the cook. And it goes as follows. Mendicants, suppose a foolish, incompetent, and unskillful cook was to serve a ruler or the minister with an excessive variety of curries, superbly sour, bitter, pungent, and sweet, hot, mild, salty, and bland. But that cook didn't take their master's hint. Today my master preferred this also, or he reached for it, or he took a lot of it, or he praised it. Today my master preferred the sour, or bitter, or pungent, or sweet, or hot, or mild, or salty sauce, or he preferred the bland sauce, or he reached for the bland one, or he took a lot of it, or he praised it. He did not take the master's hint. Yeah, this is kind of, he went wrong, this cook. He didn't observe properly. That foolish, incompetent, unskillful cook does not get presented with clothes, wages, or bonuses. Why is that? Because they don't take the master's hint. Yeah, so if you're going to be a good cook, you've got to look at what the master is eating. And then when you look at what the master is eating, the master will give you a bonus afterwards, give you extra money, and then you become a happy cook. In the same way, So that this is what happens in meditation. In the same way, a foolish, incompetent, unskillful mendicant meditates by observing an aspect of the body, keen, aware, mindful, rid of desire and aversion for the world. As they meditate observing an aspect of the body, their mind does not enter immersion, does not come to samadhi, and their corruptions are not given up. This corruptions here refers to defilements of the mind, so temporary defilements. Upakilesas, this is refers to the five hindrances really here. The hindrances are not abandoned, but they don't take the hint. They meditate observing all these other things, and still they don't enter immersion, and the corruptions, the defilements are not given up. They don't get the hint as to what to do in the same way as that unskillful cook. That is how you are an unskillful meditator. Ooh, it's going to be... So this unskillful meditator is the one who uses satipatthana, does not enter samadhi from entering satipatthana. That foolish, incompetent, unskillful mendicant does not get blissful meditations in this very life, nor do they get mindfulness or clear comprehension, situational awareness. Why is that? Because they don't take their mind's hint. Suppose an astute, competent, skillful cook was to serve a ruler or the minister with an excessive variety of curries, superbly sour, bitter, pungent and sweet, hot and mild, salty and bland. And that cook took their master's hint. Today my master preferred this sauce, or he reached for it, or he took a lot of it, or he praised it. Today my master preferred the sour, or the bitter, or the pungent, or the sweet, or the hot, or the mild, or the salty sauce. Or he preferred the bland sauce, or he reached for the bland one, or he took a lot of it, or he praised it. Thus the astute, competent, skillful cook gets presented with clothes, wages and bonuses. Why is that? Because they take their master's hint. In the same way, the astute, competent, skillful mendicant meditates by observing an aspect of the body, keen, aware and mindful, rid of desire and aversion for the world. As they meditate, observing an aspect of the body, their mind enters samadhi. Their defilements, their upakilesas, their five hindrances are given up. They do take the hint. They meditate observing an aspect of feelings, of the mind, or principles. And again, as they do that, their mind enters samadhi, and their five hindrances, their defilements are given up temporarily. They do take the hint. That astute, competent, skillful mendicant gets blissful meditation in this very life, and they get mindfulness and clear comprehension. Why is that? Because they take their mind's hint. So, this is here shows the purpose of satipatthana practice. Yeah, this is kind of the point of this. And the purpose of satipatthana practice, if you do it in the right way, is to gain samadhi. Yeah, this is what happens when you do that. Not only do you gain samadhi, but what it says at the very end there, you also gain sati sampajanya. You gain clarity about things. And of course, that sati sampajanya that you have as you come out after samadhi, that is the kind of sati that is useful for insight and for destroying all the defilements, and then to make you a stream entry, and also eventually to make you an arahant. So, and this is something that you see throughout the suttas, this idea that the purpose of satipatthana practice is to give rise to jhana states, samadhi, and giving up the defilements, and then to give you the foundation for real insight practice after you have attained the samadhi. And this is one of the reasons why I wanted to point this out, because you find this in a number of places in the suttas, and it is an important point to keep in mind why we are doing this. And of course, as we come to the very end of the Noble Eightfold Path, which we are now, this is the seventh factor. The factor after that is Samma Samadhi, then the seventh factor leads on to the eighth factor, to Sammasamadhi. Sammasati becomes the foundation for Sammasamadhi. And this is what this shows right there. So, I'm not going to say anything more about that. So, let's have a break and then come back again in about 20 minutes or so.